This is an RNIB Connect radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark important moments in their life, from maybe that first track they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest today is Ken Reed, a long-time volunteer and fundraiser for both the RNIB and a number of other sight loss organisations. Ken was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa back in 1986. Hello, Ken, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hi, Toby. Lovely to be here.
Ken, your first track, which we will hear in a moment, takes you back to, I think, very early school days and a nickname, Hank, which I think might give away the band of your chosen track. But before we hear the track, would you mind just sort of painting me a picture of your life at this age? Where did you grow up and what was sort of school life like for you?
Okay, yeah, Hank was my nickname at school. And for those who are of a similar age to myself, they will no doubt remember Hank Marvin, who's the guitarist with The Shadows. So leading you to where we're going to. I was wearing heavy glasses at that stage, and most of my peers were not wearing glasses at all. So I kind of stood out from the crowd. And that's where the nickname came from. I'm quite tall, quite thin, and heavy glasses. I looked like Hank Marvin, so people thought. And so it became my nickname. But actually, I realised I quite enjoyed listening to The Shadows' music. So it was quite a comfortable nickname to take on. I was quite relaxed about that. This was in Edinburgh, just to give the background. I was born and raised in Edinburgh, and all my education took place there. And although I was wearing glasses, I was, to all intents and purposes, fully sighted. My glasses were meant to provide full adjustment to an astigmatism and short-sightedness. But otherwise, I was pretty much thinking I was fully sighted. So, yeah, I went through mainstream education and pretty regular childhood, really. Nothing massive stood out from the crowd in that time. And whilst I was at school, I got into music a bit and went out and bought my first ever album. And the first album I bought was The Shadows Live at the Paris Olympia. I actually bought it on cassette. Now we really are getting to stretch people's memories if they can remember what cassettes were. But it was great. And and that became, yeah, the band, the sign of the start of my music education.
What was it like sort of getting your hands on that first album or cassette and listening to, sort of Apache, the track that you've chosen for the first time?
Well, I was very familiar with it. I'd heard it on the radio many, many times. But being able to play an album at home, that was quite a novelty. The quality, now thinking back, obviously cassettes were not great quality. It was a small portable cassette player. It wasn't a Walkman. They had not yet been invented. So it was one of these small personal cassette players with a loudspeaker on it. So the quality was dreadful. And I don't know how long many times I got to play it before it got chewed up inside the machine, as cassettes were wont to do. But it was really exciting to be able to play music for the first time ever.
And sort of what memories of school life and early life come back to you when you hear Apache again now, sort of on your smart speaker, I suspect, nowadays?
Absolutely. Smart devices are my players of choice. So, yeah, as I say, my school days were unremarkable. They were fairly happy and contented. And many of the things that will come up later actually had their foundation in those early years. A lot of what I started doing then I continue to do. So we'll probably talk about some of that as we move forward.
Hank Marvin and some great guitar work there on Apache by The Shadows. We now come to the time, Ken, when you were diagnosed with sight loss. And I think this was possibly quite a difficult time for you. And I wondered, what you sort of felt like when you were diagnosed with sight loss and how you may have coped with that sort of diagnosis.
Well, as with everybody, it's a fairly shocking diagnosis. And as I was saying earlier, I went through my school life and early years wearing glasses, but not with any knowledge of there being anything seriously wrong with my eyes. I thought glasses corrected everything. And then in my mid-20s, I was starting to have some problems. And I went, first of all, to my optometrist for my regular eye test. And I told them some of the things I was noticing were rather difficult and different to other people. And the optometrist did a little bit of poking around. This was the second time, actually, that I'd mentioned this to an optometrist, different optometrist. And this one maybe was a little bit more switched on, I'm not sure. But anyway, she did a little bit of investigating. And she said, "Have you ever heard of retinitis pigmentosa?" And I had to say, "Never heard of it." And she said, "Okay, it's a genetic degenerative condition, which I know very well now. And I think you maybe have it, but I can't give you a formal diagnosis." And then the process, the pathway was to go to your GP, which I did. The GP pulled a dusty book off his shelf and said, never come across somebody with that before, which is quite unusual because it's not that rare a condition in sight loss terms, but not something that every GP sees every day of the week. And they said, "Well, yeah, fine. The pathway from here is that I have to send you to the eye hospital." I got went straight from my GP to the eye hospital, and I saw an ophthalmologist who did field tests and had a look inside my eye, and he confirmed my diagnosis. The diagnosis said, "Yes, you have got retinitis pigmentosa. It is degenerative. It will be genetic, but we're not really that sure about how the genes work at this stage. There's nothing we can do about it anyway. We just know that it's progressive. So thanks very much for coming in. Goodbye." And that was me. I was kicked out. Nothing we can do to help you, so we're not going to talk to you. Fortunately, they did say, "We'll keep an eye on you to see how quickly it progresses." So I was kept in the system for that. But there was no support, no counselling, no awareness, I knew it was progressive, but was that going to be in 6 months, 6 years, 60 years? Gosh. I had no idea. And by the time I got home, I couldn't even remember exactly what the condition was called. It wasn't written down for me. I think I got retinitis pigmentosa or something like that. I got the bits back to front. And and of course there was no internet either. So it was kind of off you go. You're on your own, pal. And that was pretty devastating. So it was a tough time. And I had to kind of get used to the fact that I was now going to go blind. I was 26. So in modern terms, that's quite old to be diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa. But back in the 80s, that was probably quite normal, because it had to progress to a certain stage before anybody thought to look for it. So I was driving. The day before my formal diagnosis, I drove, and I still think about it which makes me shiver, because I nearly killed somebody on that day because I didn't see them through the narrowing tunnel that I had. My tunnel was already extremely restricted. I could only see in the old-fashioned form of field test, you could cover everything I could see with a dinner plate. So basically, if you put a dinner plate on a wall about 2 meters in front of your face, I could only see the dinner plate. I couldn't see the wall. And I was driving. And it makes me think, that I only nearly killed somebody. Oh, so fortunate that I didn't. And I never drove after that day. I just came home and said, "I can't drive." I was told I could drive during the day and stop driving at night and try and avoid driving during the day. I'm never going to drive again. At that stage, I still had fairly functional residual vision. I still could see this dinner plate on the wall. I could read. I could ride my bike. I could go walking. I could see things around and about. I could enjoy the landscape and all the rest of it. So I was okay. I could see stuff and get on with things. But I had to recognise that my sight was deteriorating and was going to be progressively deteriorating. So I told my employer straight away and they said, that's fine. We didn't employ you because of your ability to drive. It was actually given as one of the conditions of the job was that I should have a licence. However, they accepted that it's not a necessary part of the job and there was public transport, trains and buses would get me to everywhere I needed to go. And they said, that's fine. We can work with you. And because I've been open and honest about it, they were very flexible about it. And they were a great employer. I worked with them for 22 years after that and in a variety of roles as my sight deteriorated and they made adjustments and they gave me different work to do, gave me lots of opportunities and experiences. So they were a great company to work for and they don't exist anymore.
And I believe not long after your diagnosis, you started sort of volunteering and campaigning to help to improve the lives of other blind and partially sighted people. Was that a way of sort of, I suppose, helping others and giving something back?
Well, yes, it was, absolutely. Yeah, I'd been given this diagnosis. They said, you will go blind. There was no choice. There was no vagueness about it. They didn't tell me when. And they said, it's a condition we don't really know much about. We don't know exactly what's going wrong. We don't know how to, we have no treatment for it. And I thought, well, it sounds like my future is fairly clear, but that doesn't need to be the future for everybody forevermore. So at that stage, I had quite early on in that time got in touch with what was then called the British Retinitis Pigmentosa Society, now called Retina UK. And they were very much focused on trying to understand the condition and helping people to come to terms with it and to live with it, but also to find ways of preventing it. So, yeah, I got involved as a volunteer helping to run the local RP branch for people with the condition who met together and discussed aspects of it, but also in fundraising to help to improve the research so that we could tell what was going wrong and hopefully one day stop it happening. As I said, my path was clear. I knew where I was going. And I know medical science doesn't move at lightning speed. So anything that the research would come up with wasn't going to benefit me directly, but it would benefit the generations to come that others won't have to follow the same path as I've gone down, was going to have to go down. So right at the very beginning, I knew it wasn't going to really help me directly, but it would help subsequent generations, my children, my grandchildren, potentially. I didn't have either at the time, but just it was for the future that I got involved and started raising funds to pay for research. So cycled across Ireland, ran London Marathon, various other things, the triathlon. I've done lots of active things, but I've done active things in aid of sight loss charities because they matter.
Ken, I think the title of your next track gives a sort of nod to blindness and probably not your course, but it's Blinded by the Light by Manfred Mann's Earth Band. And I wondered what sort of got you sort of, I suppose, into their music, first of all.
Well, I did say that it was the mid-80s when I was diagnosed. That kind of gives you a clue of my age. And bands like Manfred Mann's Earth Band were a very much a core part of my music upbringing as I progressed from the Shadows to something a little bit rockier. And so prog rock, as it's called, has been a really mainstay of my music listening from the late 70s onwards. And this particular song, Blinded by the Light, I wasn't blinded by the light, I was blinded by my genes. That's neither here nor there. It's a song, and it isn't really about sight loss, but it's just a song that titles blindness. So it's great to have you'll find the same with Will Be True of all my songs. They kind of make a reference to something that's relevant to my life, but doesn't really talk about how that affects my life. It kind of works in there. So being blind and singing a song about blinded by the light, and then it's music that I really enjoy. So it kind of works in all those different directions. Wrapped up like a noose, you know.
Manfred's Mann's Earth Band there, and Blinded by the Light, and I think another great guitar solo too. We now come to the early 1980s for you, Ken, and a time when you took up cycling. What made you want to sort of get on the back of a tandem and pedal away?
I started riding a bike, actually a wee bit later. It was, yeah, the early 80s it would be. I started riding a bike in a serious sort of way. When I finished my student days, I went to live in the Midlands of England, Stratford-upon-Avon, which is very nice and lots of lovely countryside. But I'd been a hill walker and there were very, very few hills. So I thought, what am I going to do? So I decided to start riding a bike instead. And I got a solo bike and headed off and did lots of cycling around and about Warwickshire and further afield and thoroughly enjoyed cycling. That was great, and came back up to live in Scotland. And although I could now access the hills, I still wanted to ride a bike. And so I kept hold of my bicycle and rode that. And then obviously a bit later on, I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, and I was told I was going to go blind. Although I had stopped driving, I didn't have to stop cycling my solo bike immediately, not in 1986 when I was diagnosed. But by 1990, my sight had progressed so far that it was getting dangerous. I was riding in the countryside, and I couldn't actually tell the difference between the black of the road surface and the green of the verge. And I was finding it difficult to keep the two apart and went into the wrong bit from time to time. Great on roads with a white line down the side. I could follow the white line. And I realised I was actually following the white line far too much. And when there wasn't one, I had no idea where to go. So it was becoming too risky. And so I investigated tandem cycling. And had no real knowledge of tandems, hadn't ever ridden a tandem, didn't know what it was going to be like. And at that stage, I was married and my wife was quite a lot shorter than I am. So we investigated getting a hand-built tandem that would suit the two of us. What I didn't know is that in basic physics, a lever pivots from the central point. So if you think about a bicycle, the handlebars are the start point, and the body of the bike is the lever, and it pivots away from the handlebars. Now, on a tandem, that lever is very long, and the longer a lever is, the less pressure you need to apply on it to move it. So you've got a really long lever. Then you put a heavyweight male body on the end of that, and a lighter weight female body at the front of it. It makes it extremely hard to balance, and we never managed to ride the bike. And they do say that wherever your relationship is going, it'll get there faster than a tandem. Whether that's true in our situation, I don't know. But we did get there in the end, and we're no longer together. But we did try tandem riding. It gave me a taste for it, but my tandem ended up in the garage. Some years later, I was chatting to some male friends who were going off riding on their solos. And I said, oh, wow, that sounds great. I used to ride a bike. And I said, did you? Yeah. And I've got a tandem, but I don't ride it. Really? We'll ride it with you. Several of them said this. And so loads of guys that I knew who were riding solos said, oh, we'll take a stint on the front of your tandem. And so I got lots of people who were happy to start piloting me on my tandem. So I got out of my bike, got back into riding, and it was great. So did lots of cycling. And I have continued cycling ever since. And I've got rid of that tandem. It was a bike that was definitely designed for a smaller person at the front. And I bought a bike that was designed for a bigger person at the front. And that made it much easier for those who are willing to have a go. And the most exciting ride of all probably was, it's now getting on a bit, but it was 7 years ago. I decided I wanted to do something for RNIB. I was coming up for 30 years from my diagnosis, so this would be 2016, and I wanted to do something, and had a great idea. I thought I could cycle around the British Isles, which it might not be the sort of thing that many people would come up with, but it came to my head. I started talking to RNIB about it. They said, yeah, this sounds like a great idea. We think we can help to support you do this. I talked to a friend who liked to design routes, and he came up with a route for me. And the idea was to ride from Edinburgh to London, but go via Belfast and Dublin and Cardiff. And that was great. And so we put together the plan. I decided quite early on that I would ride with a different pilot every day. And that was one of the big things that RNIB helped me with. They put out the word in the different parts of the country that I was going to be passing through, that this was going to happen. And would somebody like to volunteer to ride one of the days? And folks did. Every single day, people came forward. And these were people I had never met. So the 3 days in Scotland was one person who'd come forward at the beginning of the process. He rode the 3 days with me from Edinburgh down to Cairn Ryan, where I got the ferry to Belfast. After that, I had a different pilot every day. I had never met them before I did the ride. I didn't know who they were, didn't know anything about them, but they were willing to have a go and to be my pilot for the day. And of course, they knew the local environment, they knew the roads that they were going to take and things. So I was fairly confident that they would get me from where I was starting to where I wanted to finish. Whereas if I'd gone with somebody from where I lived, they wouldn't have had a clue where they were going. So it was much more sensible to have somebody who knew, and they knew where all the good coffee shops were, where I could get a cake. And it was a much better idea. But it really illustrated an important part of living with sight loss, and that is trust. I had to trust these people who rocked up in the morning and said, I'm your pilot for today, that they were going to be safe, that they were going to take me to where I needed to go. We were disappearing off into the wilds of all sorts of parts of the country, obviously, and that they weren't axe murderers. They were going to be nice people. And they were. Every single one of them was wonderful.
Ken, of course, your next track has to be Bicycle Race by Queen.
It does.
Have you always been a bit of a Queen fan?
Well, once again, it comes from the same sort of musical origins. It's the 70s, it's progressive rock. Yeah, it's a great band. It's good music that I enjoyed way before I knew anything about sight loss. I actually enjoyed it before I liked riding bicycles as well. But it's a great song to recognise riding bicycles. So just ring the bells and ride the bikes and let's get on with it.
Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle.
I want to ride my
bicycle, bicycle, bicycle.
I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my
Off goes Queen there with Bicycle Race. We now leave the bicycle behind for a wee while for our next track, as we are going to be taking to the hills. As I know, walking is something that you've really enjoyed over the years, Ken. And some people might say walking for somebody who's visually impaired might be a little bit of a sort of strange thing to do, because obviously you're dealing with different terrains and things like that, and might be a little bit tricky. How do you sort of get on when you're walking up in the hills and mountains?
Yeah, I have been walking in the hills since my school days. And I was never into team sports particularly, but I loved going walking and was organised. And I got into bike riding because I couldn't walk because of the location I was in. So when I was back in Scotland, I certainly wanted to get back into walking. And even though my sight has deteriorated to the point where I can't see where I'm putting my feet, I can still enjoy being in the outdoors and enjoy the feeling of being up the hills, the exhilaration of climbing the hills, of reaching the summit, of hugging the trig point at the top of the hill, of the sense of space that you pick up from being in that kind of environment. It's just so much bigger than being in a city centre with buildings all around you. You can tell, even if you can't see it, and I can't really see, I can only see light and dark now, so I've got no idea what the horizon is like, but I just know it's out there. And I guess I have got a visual memory of having been in those kind of places when I could see. And so I can stand at the top of a hill and feel that I know what's there. I have no idea really what's out there. And I walk with my partner and she will describe a lot of what's there, other hills, the lochs, the forests, everything that's around and about, and the clouds and the sky, what that's like, everything. So I get a good visual picture, a verbal picture of the environment. But it's a lovely feeling. And I do like walking. You don't have to be going to Everest. You don't even have to be going to UK's highest mountain, Ben Nevis. You can just go for a walk in the park, just go up your local hills, whatever the size they may happen to be, and enjoy all the sounds, the smells, and the feel on your skin. Great.
What is the track, Ken, that you have chosen that does take you to those sort of hills and mountains, and does the sort of, I suppose, the lyrics or the actual feeling of the track take you back to those hills?
So the track for walking is Wild Mountain Time, a very well-known song. It's been recorded multiple times by a great many different people over the years. Probably the Byrds would be the best-known version for many people. And clearly it talks about walking in hills and the smells of the herbs that you will get from as you walk around. So it's lovely. It's a great experience. And the version I've asked to be included is by a band called the Tannahill Weavers. It's very much in the very traditional Scottish folk idiom rather than taking a rock format. And Robert Tannahill was the person who actually wrote the song, and the band took their name from him. So I thought it was highly appropriate to use their version of the song. And it allows me to introduce folk music alongside my rock music tendencies, because I do have a broad-ish taste in music. There are certain things don't get close to me, but I do certainly like folk music, I like rock music. So I wanted to make sure there was some folk music in my selection of songs. And so that is the Tannahill Weavers version of Wild Mountain Time.
The summer time is come, and the trees are sweetly blooming.
So Tannahill Weavers there, and a track that does take you out to the wild mountains and hills. We are, in a way, sort of linking back to your cycling now, Ken, with your next track, which in a way is, I think, also sort of links up between sort of audiobooks and how accessible they are and why it is so important for us all as blind and partially sighted people to listen to audiobooks or to read anyway, which is, it is so important, isn't it?
Absolutely. So when I'm not climbing the hills or riding my bike, then I'm often to be found with a book. And that has been true for a large part of my life. And as my sight deteriorated, I went from reading regular print very, very slowly to reading large print to reading audio. And now I also read in Braille. And I think it's great to have the choice. And it's wonderful that all of these different options are available to people. And most of my reading for leisure is done in audio. And it was quite a shock when I started looking for audiobooks, how limited the choice of audiobooks is. I do a lot of public speaking on behalf of RNIB, and particularly to raise funds for talking books. And currently the RNIB Talking Book Library has something in just over 30,000 titles in it. That sounds like a lot of books, but there are well over 3 million titles in the English language. So our share, or the portion of the total that we can access, is tiny. And that means that quite often blind and partially sighted people are excluded from reading the same books as their peers. So our choice of books is very limited. So that bike ride that I referred to, where I toured the British Isles in aid of RNIB, that was specifically to support talking books. And people were hugely generous, and I was really quite humbled by the generosity of all the people I met, all the people who supported the ride. And as a result, we put 6 new books into the library. It was only 6 on top of 30,000, but it's 6 more books that blind and partially sighted people are able to read.
I think your next track combines your most favourite sort of book along with your favourite band, and I wondered, what's the connection between the two of them?
Indeed. So the track is Galadriel, Galadriel, for those who don't know, is a character from Lord of the Rings, one of the very few women who make an appearance in Lord of the Rings, as it happens. And Lord of the Rings is, like so many people of my age, I suspect, it's a book that I've enjoyed reading many times. I'm actually just partway through reading it again. That's the title of the song. The band who produced this particular song is Barclay James Harvest. So we're kind of going back to my prog rock time, and I've seen this band live on a number of occasions. I do enjoy listening to their music as well. So it's great to be able to bring them in both as good music and a reference to a really great book.
To be young, and if you see her, you
Barclay James Harvest there, and a track that's related to a book and maybe a bit more prog rock too. We now come to a track, Ken, that's dedicated to your partner, who you've been with, I think, for over a decade now. How did you both first meet?
Hilda and I met online. We were both single, both wanting to meet with people, and we went onto one of these dating sites, and it worked. It's worked extremely well. So if anybody's nervous about trying that as an approach to meeting somebody, when you get into your 50s, as I was, then meeting casually is a lot harder. Most of the people I met were already in relationships. Being blind made it a bit harder too, because you can't do the casual thing of checking if seeing somebody's wearing a ring or any of those kind of giveaways. So I thought, yeah, this is a thing to do, and it worked very well for us. We met up. We've been together now for 12 and a half years. My partner is Dutch, and in Netherlands they celebrate 12 and a half years as a copper anniversary. It's not full Annie, but there you go. And so we've just had our copper celebration. And I wanted to include a song that would allow me to speak of the changes that she's brought to my life over these 12 and a half years. And I've mentioned, you know, that we go walking together, we read together. Yeah, there's all sorts of ways in which we have spent good time together. And because she's Dutch, I thought, well, how do I find a song that fits in with my personal taste in music and gives me some reference to the Netherlands? And I chose a song called Amsterdam by Al Stewart. She's not from Amsterdam, she's from another part of the Netherlands, but most of the rest of the Netherlands doesn't get featured in songs, so Amsterdam has to be. And Al Stewart kind of gives a little bit of a crossover between the folk music, which I referred to with the Tannehill Weavers, and the slightly more rocky music that we've been looking at. And he edges towards the rock end of folk. As a singer-songwriter, he's been a part of my experience, again, for an awful long time. I probably first listened to Al Stewart back in the 70s, but he's now in his 70s and he's still performing, so great stuff to him. So Amsterdam just reminds me of my partner.
Oh, I just came back from Harlem, and the very thing I was wanting was to find some way to let you know how I felt. You can't say much in an evening if you know you'll soon be.
Al Stewart there, and a track for your partner, Ken, too. Now we come to your final track, Ken. What is it and why have you chosen it?
Okay, so the last track is to be something that gives a sense of hope. And I've chosen for this And Can It Be, which is a hymn by Charles Wesley. I've been a Christian for most of my life, and having a faith has been really important as a way. It's undoubtedly it's helped me to cope with what sight loss has brought to me, and some of the harder parts of life is giving them a way of looking at the bigger picture and saying it's not all about me, and there's much more going on. But having that faith there has really been just an important part of it, and it's impacted not just on how I've managed to live with my at my sight loss, but on so many other aspects of my life that have become important. And yeah, I've talked about being in the outdoors and enjoying and appreciating that. And my faith, I think, is an important part of that as well, that creation is something that we've been gifted and to appreciate and enjoy in whatever way we can. And I may not be able to see it anymore, but I can still appreciate it being there. And that feel has given me a responsibility as well. I feel very strongly that we have to care for that creation. So I could do another series of songs that would relate to some of the important lessons I've learned in such an area, about the importance of caring for our environment, about living in a sustainable manner, and being living at peace. And all of those things are things which my faith gives me hope for in the future. And I will continue to work for them as well as for the future of people who are blind and partially sighted.
Well, that's a wonderful way to end your Tracks of My Life. And thank you very much indeed, Ken Reid, for sharing your Tracks of My Life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks, Toby. It's been a pleasure.